When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Chapter 9 of Pellucidar by Edgar Rice Burroughs. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Pellucidar. Chapter 9. Hooja's Cutthroats Appear. I had built a little shelter of rocks and brush where I might crawl in and sleep out of the perpetual light and heat of the noonday sun. When I was tired or hungry, I retired to my humble cot. My masters never interposed the slightest objection. As a matter of fact, they were very good to me, nor did I see aught while I was among them to indicate that they are ever else than a simple, kindly folk when left to themselves. Their awe-inspiring size, terrific strength, mighty fighting fangs, and hideous appearance are but the attributes necessary to the successful waging of their constant battle for survival, and well do they employ them when the need arises. The only flesh they eat is that of herbivorous animals and birds. When they hunt the mighty thag, the prehistoric boss of the outer crust, a single male with his fiber rope will catch and kill the greatest of the bulls. Well, as I was about to say, I had this little shelter at the edge of my melon patch. Here I was resting from my labors on a certain occasion when I heard a great hubbub in the village, which lay about a quarter of a mile away. Presently a male came racing toward the field, shouting excitedly. As he approached, I came from my shelter to learn what all the commotion might be about, for the monotony of my existence in the melon patch must have fostered that trait of my curiosity from which it had always been my secret boast I am peculiarly free. The other workers also ran forward to meet the messenger, who quickly unburdened himself of his information, and as quickly turned and scampered back toward the village. When running, these beastmen often go upon all fours. Thus they leap over obstacles that would slow up a human being, and upon the level attain a speed that would make a thoroughbred look to his laurels. The result in this instance was that, before I had more than assimilated the gist of the word which had been brought to the fields, I was alone, watching my co-workers speeding villageward. I was alone. It was the first time since my capture that no beast-man had been within sight of me. I was alone, and all my captors were in the village at the opposite edge of the mesa repelling an attack of Hooja's horde. It seemed from the messenger's tale that two of Gur-Gur-Gur's great males had been set upon by a half-dozen of Hooja's cutthroats, while the former were peaceably returning from the thag hunt. The two had returned to the village unscratched, while but a single one of Hooja's half-dozen had escaped to report the outcome of the battle to their leader. Now Hooja was coming to punish Gur-Gur-Gur's people. With his large force, armed with bows and arrows that Hooja had learned from me to make, with long lances and sharp knives, I feared that even the mighty strength of the beast-men could avail them but little. At last had come the opportunity for which I waited. I was free to make for the far end of the mesa, find my way to the valley below, and, while the two forces were engaged in their struggle, continue my search for Hooja's village, which I had learned from the beast-men lay farther on down the river that I had been following when taken prisoner. As I returned to make for the mesa's rim, the sounds of battle came plainly to my ears, the hoarse shouts of men mingled with the half-beastly roars and growls of the brute folk. Did I take advantage of my opportunity? I did not. Instead, lured by the din of strife and by the desire to deliver a stroke, however feeble, against hated Hooja, I wheeled and ran directly toward the village. When I reached the edge of the plateau, such a scene met my astonished gaze as never before had startled it, for the unique battle methods of the half-brutes were rather the most remarkable I had ever witnessed. Along the very edge of the cliff-top stood a thin line of mighty males, the best rope-throwers of the tribe. A few feet behind these, the rest of the males, with the exception of about 20, formed a second line. Still farther in the rear, all the women and young children were clustered into a single group under the protection of the remaining 20 fighting males and all the old males. But it was the work of the first two lines that interested me. The forces of Hooja, a great horde of savage Sagoths and primeval cavemen, were working their way up the steep cliff face, their agility but slightly less than that of my captors who had clambered so nimbly aloft, even he who was burdened by my weight. As the attackers came on, they paused occasionally wherever a projection gave them sufficient foothold and launched arrows and spears at the defenders above them. During the entire battle, both sides hurled taunts and insults at one another, the human beings naturally excelling the brutes in the coarseness and vileness of their vilification and invective. The firing line of brute men wielded no weapon other than their long fiber nooses. When a foeman came within range of them, a noose would settle unerringly about him, and he would be dragged, fighting and yelling, to the cliff-top, unless, as occasionally occurred, he was quick enough to draw his knife and cut the rope above him, in which event he usually plunged downward to a no less certain death than that which awaited him above. Those who were hauled up within reach of the powerful clutches of the defenders had the nooses snatched from them and were catapulted back through the first line to the second, where they were seized and killed by the simple expedient of a single powerful closing of mighty fangs upon the backs of their necks. But the arrows of the invaders were taking a much heavier toll than the nooses of the defenders, and I foresaw that it was but a matter of time before Hooja's forces must conquer, unless the brute men changed their tactics or the cavemen tired of the battle. Gur-gur-gur was standing in the center of the first line. All about him were boulders and large fragments of broken rock. I approached him, and without a word toppled a large mass of rock over the edge of the cliff. It fell directly upon the head of an archer, crushing him to instant death and carrying his mangled corpse with it to the bottom of the declivity, and on its way brushing three more of the attackers into the hereafter. Gur-gur-gur turned toward me in surprise. For an instant he appeared to doubt the sincerity of my motives. I felt that perhaps my time had come when he reached for me with one of his giant paws, but I dodged him and, running a few paces to the right, hurled down another missile. It too did its allotted work of destruction. Then I picked up smaller fragments, and with all the control and accuracy for which I had earned justly deserved fame in my collegiate days, I rained down a hail of death upon those beneath me. Gur-gur-gur was coming toward me again. I pointed to the litter of rubble upon the cliff-top. "Hurl these down upon the enemy!" I cried to him. "Tell your warriors to throw rocks down upon them!" At my words, the others of the first line, who had been interested spectators of my tactics, seized upon great boulders or bits of rock, whichever came first to their hands, and, without waiting for a command from Gur-gur-gur, deluged the terrified cavemen with a perfect avalanche of stone. In less than no time the cliff face was stripped of enemies, and the village of Gur-gur-gur was saved. Gur-gur-gur was standing beside me when the last of the cavemen disappeared in rapid flight down the valley. He was looking at me intently. "Those were your people," he said. "Why did you kill them?" "They were not my people," I returned. "I have told you that before, but you would not believe me. Will you believe me now when I tell you that I hate Hooja and his tribe as much as you do? Will you believe me when I tell you that I wish to be the friend of Gur-gur-gur?" For some time he stood there beside me, scratching his head. Evidently it was no less difficult for him to readjust his preconceived conclusions than it is for most human beings. But finally the idea percolated, which it might never have done had he been a man, or I might qualify that statement by saying had he been some man. Finally he spoke. "Gilak," he said, "you have made Gur-gur-gur ashamed. He would have killed you. How can he reward you?" "Set me free," I replied quickly. "You are free," he said. "You may go down when you wish, or you may stay with us. If you go, you may always return. We are your friends." Naturally, I elected to go. I explained all over again to Gur-Gur-Gur the nature of my mission. He listened attentively. After I had done, he offered to send some of his people with me to guide me to Hooja's village. I was not slow in accepting his offer. First, however, we must eat. The hunters upon whom Hooja's men had fallen had brought back the meat of a great thag. There would be a feast to commemorate the victory, a feast and dancing. I had never witnessed a tribal function of the brute folk, though I had often heard strange sounds coming from the village, where I had not been allowed since my capture. Now I took part in one of their orgies. It will live forever in my memory. The combination of bestiality and humanity was oftentimes pathetic, and again grotesque or horrible. Beneath the glaring noonday sun, in the sweltering heat of the mesa top, the huge, hairy creatures leapt in a great circle. They coiled and threw their fiber ropes. They hurled taunts and insults at an imaginary foe. They fell upon the carcass of the thag and literally tore it to pieces, and they ceased only when, gorged, they could no longer move. I had to wait until the processes of digestion had released my escort from his torpor. Some had eaten until their abdomens were so distended that I thought they must burst, for beside the thag there had been fully 100 antelopes of various sizes and varied degrees of decomposition, which they had unearthed from burial beneath the floors of their lairs to grace the banquet board. But at last we were started, 6 great males and myself. Gur-Gur-Gur had returned my weapons to me, and at last I was once more upon my oft-interrupted way toward my goal. Whether I should find Dian at the end of my journey or no, I could not even surmise. But I was nonetheless impatient to be off, for if only the worst lay in store for me, I wished to know it even the worst at once. I could scarce believe that my proud mate would still be alive in the power of Hooja. But time upon Pellucidar is so strange a thing that I realized that to her or to him only a few minutes might have elapsed since his subtle trickery had enabled him to steal her away from Phutra. Or she might have found the means either to repel his advances or escape him. As we descended the cliff, we disturbed a great pack of large hyena-like beasts, Hyena spilius, Perry calls them, who were busy among the corpses of the cavemen fallen in battle. The ugly creatures were far from the cowardly things that our own hyenas are reputed to be. They stood their ground with bared fangs as we approached them. But, as I was later to learn, so formidable are the brute folk that there are few even of the larger carnivora that will not make way for them when they go abroad. So the hyenas moved a little from our line of march, closing in again upon their feasts when we had passed. We made our way steadily down the rim of the beautiful river which flows the length of the island, coming at last to a wood rather denser than any that I had before encountered in this country. Well within this forest my escort halted. "There," they said, and pointed ahead. "We are to go no farther." Thus, having guided me to my destination, they left me. Ahead of me, through the trees, I could see what appeared to be the foot of a steep hill. Toward this I made my way. The forest ran to the very base of a cliff, in the face of which were the mouths of many caves. They appeared untenanted, but I decided to watch for a while before venturing farther. A large tree, densely foliaged, offered a splendid vantage point from which to spy upon the cliff, so I clambered among its branches, where, securely hidden, I could watch what transpired about the caves. It seemed that I had scarcely settled myself in a comfortable position before a party of cavemen emerged from one of the smaller apertures in the cliff face, about 50 feet from the base. They descended into the forest and disappeared. Soon after came several others from the same cave, and after them, at a short interval, a score of women and children, who came into the wood to gather fruit. There were several warriors with them, a guard, I presume. After this came other parties, and 2 or 3 groups who passed out of the forest and up the cliff face to enter the same cave. I could not understand it. All who came out had emerged from the same cave. All who returned re-entered it. No other cave gave evidence of habitation, and no cave but one of extraordinary size could have accommodated all the people whom I had seen pass in and out of its mouth. For a long time I sat and watched the coming and going of great numbers of the cave folk. Not once did one leave the cliff by any other opening save that from which I had seen the first party come, nor did any re-enter the cliff through another aperture. What a cave it must be, I thought, that houses an entire tribe. But, dissatisfied of the truth of my surmise, I climbed higher among the branches of the tree that I might get a better view of other portions of the cliff. High above the ground I reached a point whence I could see the summit of the hill. Evidently it was a flat-topped butte similar to that on which dwelt the tribe of Gur-Gur-Gur. As I sat gazing at it, a figure appeared at the very edge. It was that of a young girl in whose hair was a gorgeous bloom plucked from some flowering tree of the forest. I had seen her pass beneath me but a short while before and enter the small cave that had swallowed all of the returning tribesmen. The mystery was solved. The cave was but the mouth of a passage that led upward through the cliff to the summit of the hill. It served merely as an avenue from their lofty citadel to the valley below. No sooner had the truth flashed upon me than the realization came that I must seek some other means of reaching the village, for to pass unobserved through this well-traveled thoroughfare would be impossible. At the moment there was no one in sight below me, so I slid quickly from my arboreal watchtower to the ground and moved rapidly away to the right with the intention of circling the hill if necessary, until I had found an unwatched spot where I might have some slight chance of scaling the heights and reaching the top unseen. I kept close to the edge of the forest, in the very midst of which the hills seemed to rise. Though I carefully scanned the cliff as I traversed its base, I saw no sign of any other entrance than that to which my guides had led me. After some little time the roar of the sea broke upon my ears. Shortly after I came upon the broad ocean which breaks at this point at the very foot of the great hill, where Hooja had found safe refuge for himself and his villains. I was just about to clamber along the jagged rocks which lie at the base of the cliff next to the sea in search of some foothold to the top, when I chanced to see a canoe rounding the end of the island. I threw myself down behind a large boulder where I could watch the dugout and its occupants without myself being seen. They paddled toward me for a while, and then, about 100 yards from me, they turned straight in toward the foot of the frowning cliffs. From where I was it seemed that they were bent upon self-destruction, since the roar of the breakers beating upon the perpendicular rock face appeared to offer only death to anyone who might venture within their relentless clutch. A mass of rock would soon hide them from my view, but so keen was the excitement of the instant that I could not refrain from crawling forward to a point whence I could watch the dashing of the small craft to pieces on the jagged rocks that loomed before her, although I risked discovery from above to accomplish my design. When I had reached a point where I could again see the dugout, I was just in time to see it glide unharmed between two needle-pointed sentinels of granite and float quietly upon the unruffled bosom of a tiny cove. Again I crouched behind a boulder to observe what would next transpire, nor did I have long to wait. The dugout, which contained but two men, was drawn closely to the rocky wall. A fiber rope, one end of which was tied to the boat, was made fast about a projection of the cliff face. Then the two men commenced the ascent of the almost perpendicular wall toward the summit several 100 feet above. I looked on in amazement, for, splendid climbers though the cavemen of Pellucidar are, I never before had seen so remarkable a feat performed. Upwardly they moved without a pause, to disappear at last over the summit. When I felt reasonably sure that they had gone for a while at least, I crawled from my hiding place and, at the risk of a broken neck, leaped and scrambled to the spot where their canoe was moored. If they had scaled that cliff, I could, and if I couldn't, I should die in the attempt. But when I turned to the accomplishment of the task, I found it easier than I had imagined it would be, since I immediately discovered that shallow hand and footholds had been scooped in the cliff's rocky face, forming a crude ladder from the base to the summit. At last I reached the top, and very glad I was, too. Cautiously, I raised my head until my eyes were above the cliff crest. Before me spread a rough mesa, liberally sprinkled with large boulders. There was no village in sight, nor any living creature. I drew myself to level ground and stood erect. A few trees grew among the boulders. Very carefully I advanced from tree to tree and boulder to boulder toward the inland end of the mesa. I stopped often to listen and look cautiously about me in every direction. How I wished that I had my revolvers and rifle! I would not have to worm my way like a scared cat toward Hooja's village, nor did I relish doing so now. But Dian's life might hinge upon the success of my venture, and so I could not afford to take chances. To have met suddenly with discovery and had a score or more of armed warriors upon me might have been very grand and heroic, but it would have immediately put an end to all my earthly activities, nor have accomplished aught in the service of Dian. Well, I must have traveled nearly a mile across that mesa without seeing a sign of anyone, when all of a sudden, as I crept around the edge of a boulder, I ran plump into a man, down on all fours like myself, crawling toward me. End of chapter 9. Chapter 10 of Pellucidar by Edgar Rice Burroughs. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Pellucidar. Chapter 10. The Raid on the Cave Prison. His head was turned over his shoulder as I first saw him. He was looking back toward the village. As I leapt for him, his eyes fell upon me. Never in my life have I seen a more surprised mortal than this poor caveman. Before he could utter a single scream of warning or alarm, I had my fingers on his throat, and had dragged him behind the boulder, where I proceeded to sit upon him while I figured out what I had best do with him. He struggled a little at first, but finally lay still, and so I released the pressure of my fingers at his windpipe, for which I imagine he was quite thankful. I know that I should have been. I hated to kill him in cold blood, but what else was I to do with him I could not see, for to turn him loose would have been merely to have the entire village aroused and down upon me in a moment. The fellow lay looking up at me with the surprise still deeply written on his countenance. At last, all of a sudden, a look of recognition entered his eyes. "I have seen you before," he said. "I saw you in the arena at the Mahar city of Phutra, when the Thiptars dragged the Tarag from you and your mate. I never understood that. Afterward, they put me in the arena with two warriors from Gombul." He smiled in recollection. "It would have been the same had there been 10 warriors from Gombul. I slew them, winning my freedom. Look." He half turned his left shoulder toward me, exhibiting the newly healed scar of the Mahar's branded mark. "Then," he continued, "as I was returning to my people, I met some of them fleeing. They told me that one called Hooja the Sly One had come and seized our village, putting our people into slavery. So I hurried hither to learn the truth, and sure enough, here I found Hooja and his wicked men living in my village, and my father's people but slaves among them. I was discovered and captured, but Hooja did not kill me. I am the chief's son, and through me he hoped to win my father's warriors back to the village to help him in a great war he says that he will soon commence. Among his prisoners is Dian the Beautiful One, whose brother, Dakor the Strong One, chief of Amaz, once saved my life when he came to Thuria to steal a mate. I helped him capture her, and we are good friends. So when I learned that Dian the Beautiful One was Hooja's prisoner, I told him that I would not aid him if he harmed her. Recently, one of Hooja's warriors overheard me talking with another prisoner. We were planning to combine all the prisoners, seize weapons, and when most of Hooja's warriors were away, slay the rest and retake our hilltop. Had we done so, we could have held it, for there are only two entrances, the narrow tunnel at one end and the steep path up the cliffs at the other. But when Hooja heard what we had planned, he was very angry and ordered that I die. They bound me hand and foot and placed me in a cave until all the warriors should return to witness my death. But while they were away, I heard someone calling me in a muffled voice, which seemed to come from the wall of the cave. When I replied, the voice, which was a woman's, told me that she had overheard all that had passed between me and those who had brought me thither, and that she was Dakor's sister and would find a way to help me. Presently, a little hole appeared in the wall at the point from which the voice had come. After a time, I saw a woman's hand digging with a bit of stone. Dakor's sister made a hole in the wall between the cave where I lay bound and that in which she had been confined, and soon she was by my side and had cut my bonds. We talked then, and I offered to make the attempt to take her away and back to the land of Sari, where she told me she would be able to learn the whereabouts of her mate. Just now I was going to the other end of the island to see if a boat lay there, and if the way was clear for our escape. Most of the boats are always away now, for a great many of Hooja's men and nearly all of the slaves are upon the Island of Trees, where Hooja is having many boats built to carry his warriors across the water to the mouth of a great river which he discovered while he was returning from Phutra, a vast river that empties into the sea there. The speaker pointed toward the northeast. It is wide and smooth and slow-running almost to the land of Sari, he added. "And where is Dian the Beautiful One now?" I asked. I had released my prisoner as soon as I found that he was Hooja's enemy, and now the pair of us were squatting beside the boulder while he told his story. "She returned to the cave where she had been imprisoned," he replied, "and is awaiting me there."
"There is no danger that Hooja will come while you are away?"
"Hooja is upon the Island of Trees," he replied. "Can you direct me to the cave so that I can find it alone?" I asked.
He said that he could, and in the strange yet explicit fashion of the Pellucidarians he explained minutely how I might reach the cave where he had been imprisoned, and through the hole in its wall reach Dian. I thought it best for but one of us to return, since two could accomplish but little more than one and would double the risk of discovery. In the meantime he could make his way to the sea and guard the boat, which I told him lay there at the foot of the cliff. I told him to await us at the cliff-top, and if Dian came alone, to do his best to get away with her and take her to Sari, as I thought it quite possible that, in case of detection and pursuit, it might be necessary for me to hold off Hooja's people while Dian made her way alone to where my new friend was to await her. I impressed upon him the fact that he might have to resort to trickery or even to force to get Dian to leave me, but I made him promise that he would sacrifice everything, even his life, in an attempt to rescue Dakor's sister. Then we parted, he to take up his position where he could watch the boat and await Dian, I to crawl cautiously on toward the caves. I had no difficulty in following the directions given me by Juag, the name by which Dakor's friend said he was called. There was the Leaning Tree, my first point he told me to look for after rounding the boulder where we had met. After that I crawled to the Balanced Rock, a huge boulder resting upon a tiny base no larger than the palm of your hand. From here I had my first view of the village of caves. A low bluff ran diagonally across one end of the mesa, and in the face of this bluff were the mouths of many caves. Zigzag trails led up to them, and narrow ledges, scooped from the face of the soft rock, connected those upon the same level. The cave in which Juag had been confined was at the extreme end of the cliff nearest me. By taking advantage of the bluff itself, I could approach within a few feet of the aperture without being visible from any other cave. There were few people about at the time. Most of these were congregated at the foot of the far end of the bluff, where they were so engrossed in excited conversation that I felt but little fear of detection. However, I exercised the greatest care in approaching the cliff. After watching for a while until I caught an instant when every head was turned away from me, I darted, rabbit-like, into the cave. Like many of the man-made caves of Pellucidar, this one consisted of three chambers, one behind another, and all unlit except for what sunlight filtered in through the external opening. The result was gradually increasing darkness as one passed into each succeeding chamber. In the last of the three I could just distinguish objects, and that was all. As I was groping around the walls for the hole that should lead into the cave where Dian was imprisoned, I heard a man's voice quite close to me. The speaker had evidently but just entered, for he spoke in a loud tone, demanding the whereabouts of one whom he had come in search of.
"Where are you, woman?" he cried. "Hooja has sent for you!"
And then a woman's voice answered him, "And what does Hooja want of me?" The voice was Dian's. I groped in the direction of the sounds, feeling for the hole.
"He wishes you brought to the Island of Trees," replied the man, "for he is ready to take you as his mate."
"I will not go," said Dian. "I will die first."
"I am sent to bring you, and bring you I shall."
I could hear him crossing the cave toward her. Frantically I clawed the wall of the cave in which I was in an effort to find the elusive aperture that would lead me to Dian's side. I heard the sound of a scuffle in the next cave. Then my fingers sank into loose rock and earth in the side of the cave. In an instant I realized why I had been unable to find the opening while I had been lightly feeling the surface of the walls. Dian had blocked up the hole she had made lest it arouse suspicion and lead to an early discovery of Juwag's escape. Plunging my weight against the crumbling mass, I sent it crashing into the adjoining cavern. With it came I, David, Emperor of Pellucidar. I doubt if any other potentate in a world's history ever made a more undignified entrance. I landed head first on all fours, but I came quickly and was on my feet before the man in the dark guessed what had happened. He saw me, though, when I arose, and, sensing that no friend came thus precipitately, turned to meet me even as I charged him. I had my stone knife in my hand, and he had his. In the darkness of the cave there was little opportunity for a display of science, though even at that I venture to say that we fought a very pretty duel. Before I came to Pellucidar I do not recall that I ever had seen a stone knife, and I am sure that I never fought with a knife of any description. But now I do not have to take my hat off to any of them when it comes to wielding that primitive yet wicked weapon. I could just see Dian in the darkness, but I knew that she could not see my features or recognize me, and I enjoyed in anticipation, even while I was fighting for her life and mine, her dear joy when she should discover that it was I who was her deliverer. My opponent was large, but he also was active, and no mean knife man. He caught me once fairly in the shoulder. I carry the scar yet, and shall carry it to my grave. And then he did a foolish thing, for as I leapt back to gain a second in which to calm the shock of the wound, he rushed after me and tried to clinch. He rather neglected his knife for the moment in his greater desire to get his hands on me. Seeing the opening, I swung my left fist fairly to the point of his jaw. Down he went. Before ever he could scramble up again I was on him, and had buried my knife in his heart. Then I stood up. And there was Dian facing me and peering at me through the dense gloom.
"You are not Juwag!" she exclaimed. "Who are you?"
I took a step toward her, my arms outstretched. "It is I, Dian," I said. "It is David." At the sound of my voice she gave a little cry in which tears were mingled, a pathetic little cry that told me all without words how far hope had gone from her. And then she ran forward and threw herself in my arms. I covered her perfect lips and her beautiful face with kisses, and stroked her thick black hair, and told her again and again what she already knew, what she had known for years, that I loved her better than all else which two worlds had to offer. We couldn't devote much time, though, to the happiness of lovemaking, for we were in the midst of enemies who might discover us at any moment. I drew her into the adjoining cave.
Thence we made our way to the mouth of the cave that gave me entrance to the cliff. Here I reconnoitred for a moment, and seeing the coast clear, ran swiftly forth with Dian at my side. We dodged around the cliff end, then paused for an instant, listening. No sound reached our ears to indicate that any had seen us, and we moved cautiously onward along the way by which I had come. As we went, Dian told me that her captors had informed her how close I had come in search of her, even to the Land of Awful Shadow, and how one of Hooja's men who knew me had discovered me asleep and robbed me of all my possessions, and then how Hooja had sent four others to find me and take me prisoner. But these men, she said, had not yet returned, or at least she had not heard of their return. "Nor will you ever," I responded, "for they have gone to that place whence none ever returns." I then related my adventure with these four. We had come almost to the cliff edge where Juag should be awaiting us, when we saw two men walking rapidly toward the same spot from another direction. They did not see us, nor did they see Juag, whom I now discovered hiding behind a low bush close to the verge of the precipice which drops into the sea at this point. As quickly as possible, without exposing ourselves too much to the enemy, we hastened forward that we might reach Juag as quickly as they. But they noticed him first and immediately charged him, for one of them had been his guard, and they had both been sent to search for him, his escape having been discovered between the time he left the cave and the time when I reached it. Evidently they had wasted precious moments looking for him in other portions of the mesa. When I saw that the two of them were rushing him, I called out to attract their attention to the fact that they had more than a single man to cope with. They paused at the sound of my voice and looked about. When they discovered Dian and me, they exchanged a few words, and one of them continued toward Juag, while the other turned upon us. As he came nearer, I saw that he carried in his hand one of my six-shooters, but he was holding it by the barrel, evidently mistaking it for some sort of war-club or tomahawk. I could scarce refrain a grin when I thought of the wasted possibilities of that deadly revolver in the hands of an untutored warrior of the Stone Age. Had he but reversed it and pulled the trigger, he might still be alive. Maybe he is, for all I know, since I did not kill him then. When he was about 20 feet from me, I flung my javelin with a quick movement that I had learned from Gak. He ducked to avoid it, and instead of receiving it in his heart, for which it was intended, he got it on the side of the head. Down he went all in a heap. Then I glanced toward Juag. He was having a most exciting time. The fellow pitted against Juag was a veritable giant. He was hacking and hewing away at the poor slave with a villainous-looking knife that might have been designed for butchering mastodons. Step by step he was forcing Juag back toward the edge of the cliff, with a fiendish cunning that permitted his adversary no chance to sidestep the terrible consequences of retreat in this direction. I saw quickly that in another moment Juag must deliberately hurl himself to death over the precipice, or be pushed over by his foemen. And as I saw Juag's predicament, I saw, too, in the same instant, a way to relieve him. Leaping quickly to the side of the fellow I had just felled, I snatched up my fallen revolver. It was a desperate chance to take, and I realized it in the instant that I threw the gun up from my hip and pulled the trigger. There was no time to aim. Juag was upon the very brink of the chasm. His relentless foe was pushing him hard, beating at him furiously with the heavy knife. And then the revolver spoke, loud and sharp. The giant threw his hands above his head, whirled about like a huge top, and lunged forward over the precipice. And Juag? He cast a single affrighted glance in my direction. Never before, of course, had he heard the report of a firearm, and with a howl of dismay he, too, turned and plunged head foremost from sight. Horror-struck, I hastened to the brink of the abyss just in time to see two splashes upon the surface of the little cove below. For an instant I stood there watching with Dian at my side. Then, to my utter amazement, I saw Juag rise to the surface and swim strongly toward the boat. The fellow had dived that incredible distance and came up unharmed. I called to him to await us below, assuring him that he need have no fear of my weapon, since it would harm only my enemies. He shook his head and muttered something which I could not hear at so great a distance. But when I pushed him, he promised to wait for us. At the same instant, Dian caught my arm and pointed toward the village. My shot had brought a crowd of natives on the run toward us. The fellow whom I had stunned with my javelin had regained consciousness and scrambled to his feet. He was now racing as fast as he could go back toward his people. It looked mighty dark for Dian and me with that ghastly descent between us and even the beginnings of liberty, and a horde of savage enemies advancing at a rapid run. There was but one hope. That was to get Dian started for the bottom without delay. I took her in my arms just for an instant. I felt somehow that it might be for the last time. For the life of me, I couldn't see how both of us could escape. I asked her if she could make the descent alone, if she were not afraid. She smiled up at me bravely and shrugged her shoulders. She afraid? So beautiful is she that I am always having difficulty in remembering that she is a primitive, half-savage cave girl of the Stone Age, and often find myself mentally limiting her capacities to those of the effete and over-civilized beauties of the outer crust. "And you?" she asked as she swung over the edge of the cliff. "I shall follow you after I take a shot or two at our friends," I replied. "I just want to give them a taste of this new medicine which is going to cure Pellucidar of all its ills. That will stop them long enough for me to join you. Now hurry, and tell Juag to be ready to shove off the moment I reach the boat, or the instant that it becomes apparent that I cannot reach it. You, Dian, must return to Sari if anything happens to me, that you may devote your life to carrying out with Perry the hopes and plans for Pellucidar that are so dear to my heart. Promise me, dear." She hated to promise to desert me, nor would she, only shaking her head and making no move to descend. The tribesmen were nearing us. Juag was shouting up to us from below. It was evident that he realized from my actions that I was attempting to persuade Dian to descend, and that grave danger threatened us from above.
"Dive!" he cried. "Dive!"
I looked at Dian and then down at the abyss below us. The cove appeared no larger than a saucer. How Juag ever had hit it, I could not guess.
"Dive!" cried Juag. "It is the only way! There is no time to climb down!"
End of chapter 10. Chapter 11 of Pellucidar by Edgar Rice Burroughs. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Pellucidar. Chapter 11. Escape. Dian glanced downward and shuddered. Her tribe were hill people. They were not accustomed to swimming other than in quiet rivers and placid lakelets. It was not the steep that appalled her, it was the ocean, vast, mysterious, terrible. To dive into it from this great height was beyond her. I couldn't wonder either. To have attempted it myself seemed too preposterous even for thought. Only one consideration could have prompted me to leap headforemost from that giddy height—suicide. Or at least so I thought at the moment.
"Quick!" I urged Dian. "You cannot dive, but I can hold them until you reach safety." "And you?" she asked once more. "Can you dive when they come too close? Otherwise you could not escape if you waited here until I reached the bottom."
I saw that she would not leave me unless she thought that I could make that frightful dive as we had seen Juag make it. I glanced once downward. Then, with a mental shrug, I assured her that I would dive the moment that she reached the boat. Satisfied, she began the descent carefully, yet swiftly. I watched her for a moment, my heart in my mouth lest some slight misstep or the slipping of a fingerhold should pitch her to a frightful death upon the rocks below. Then I turned toward the advancing Hoojans. Hoosiers, Perry dubbed them, even going so far as to christen this island where Hooja held sway, Indiana. It is so marked now upon our maps. They were coming at a great rate. I raised my revolver, took deliberate aim at the foremost warrior, and pulled the trigger. With the bark of the gun, the fellow lunged forward. His head doubled beneath him. He rolled over and over two or three times before he came to a stop, to lie very quietly in the thick grass among the brilliant wildflowers. Those behind him halted. One of them hurled a javelin toward me, but it fell short. They were just beyond javelin range. There were two armed with bows and arrows. These I kept my eyes on. All of them appeared awestruck and frightened by the sound and effect of the firearm. They kept looking from the corpse to me and jabbering among themselves. I took advantage of the lull in hostilities to throw a quick glance over the edge toward Dian. She was halfway down the cliff and progressing finely. Then I turned back toward the enemy. One of the bowmen was fitting an arrow to his bow. I raised my hand. "Stop!" I cried. "Whoever shoots at me or advances toward me, I shall kill as I killed him." I pointed at the dead man. The fellow lowered his bow. Again there was animated discussion. I could see that those who were not armed with bows were urging something upon the two who were. At last the majority appeared to prevail, for simultaneously the two archers raised their weapons. At the same instant I fired at one of them, dropping him in his tracks. The other, however, launched his missile. But the report of my gun had given him such a start that the arrow flew wild above my head. A second after, and he, too, was sprawled upon the sward with a round hole between his eyes. It had been a rather good shot. I glanced over the edge again. Dean was almost at the bottom. I could see Juwag standing just beneath her with his hands upstretched to assist her. A sullen roar from the warriors recalled my attention toward them. They stood shaking their fists at me and yelling insults. From the direction of the village I saw a single warrior coming to join them. He was a huge fellow, and when he strode among them I could tell by his bearing and their deference toward him that he was a chieftain. He listened to all they had to tell of the happenings of the last few minutes. Then, with a command and a roar, he started for me with the whole pack at his heels. All they had needed had arrived, namely, a brave leader. I had two unfired cartridges in the chambers of my gun. I let the big warrior have one of them, thinking that his death would stop them all. But I guess they were worked up to such a frenzy of rage by this time that nothing would have stopped them. At any rate, they only yelled the louder as he fell and increased their speed toward me. I dropped another with my remaining cartridge. Then they were upon me, or almost. I thought of my promise to Dian. The awful abyss was behind me. A big devil with a huge bludgeon in front of me. I grasped my six-shooter by the barrel and hurled it squarely in his face with all my strength. Then, without waiting to learn the effect of my throw, I wheeled, ran the few steps to the edge, and leapt as far out over that frightful chasm as I could. I know something of diving, and all that I know I put into that dive, which I was positive would be my last. For a couple of hundred feet I fell in horizontal position. The momentum I gained was terrific. I could feel the air almost as a solid body, so swiftly I hurtled through it. Then my position gradually changed to the vertical, and with hands outstretched I slipped through the air, cleaving it like a flying arrow. Just before I struck the water, a perfect shower of javelins fell all about. My enemies had rushed to the brink and hurled their weapons after me. By a miracle I was untouched. In the final instant I saw that I had cleared the rocks and was going to strike the water fairly. Then I was in and plumbing the depths. I suppose I didn't really go very far down, but it seemed to me that I should never stop. When at last I dared curve my hands upward and divert my progress toward the surface, I thought that I should explode for air before I ever saw the sun again except through a swirl of water. but at last my head popped above the waves and I filled my lungs with air. Before me was the boat, from which Juag and Dian were clamoring. I couldn't understand why they were deserting it now, when we were about to set out for the mainland in it, but when I reached its side I understood. Two heavy javelins, missing Dian and Juag by but a hair's breadth, had sunk deep into the bottom of the dugout in a straight line with the grain of the wood, and split her almost in two from stem to stern. She was useless. Juag was leaning over a nearby rock, his hand outstretched to aid me in clambering to his side, nor did I lose any time in availing myself of his proffered assistance. An occasional javelin was still dropping perilously close to us, so we hastened to draw as close as possible to the cliffside, where we were comparatively safe from the missiles. Here we held a brief conference, in which it was decided that our only hope now lay in making for the opposite end of the island as quickly as we could, and utilizing the boat that I had hidden there to continue our journey to the mainland. Gathering up three of the least damaged javelins that had fallen about us, we set out upon our journey, keeping well toward the south side of the island, which Juag said was less frequented by the Hoojins than the central portion where the river ran. I think that this ruse must have thrown our pursuers off our track, since we saw nothing of them nor heard any sound of pursuit during the greater portion of our march the length of the island. But the way Juag had chosen was rough and roundabout, so that we consumed one or two more marches in covering the distance than if we had followed the river. This it was which proved our undoing. Those who sought us must have sent a party up the river immediately after we escaped, for when we came at last onto the river trail, not far from our destination, there can be no doubt but that we were seen by Hoojins who were just ahead of us on the stream. The result was that as we were passing through a clump of bush a score of warriors leapt out upon us, and before we could scarce strike a blow in defense had disarmed and bound us. For a time thereafter I seemed to be entirely bereft of hope. I could see no ray of promise in the future, only immediate death for Juag and me, which didn't concern me much in the face of what lay in store for Dian. Poor child! What an awful life she had led! From the moment that I had first seen her chained in the slave caravan of the Mahars until now, a prisoner of a no less cruel creature, I could recall but a few brief intervals of peace and quiet in her tempestuous existence. Before I had known her, Jubal the Ugly One had pursued her across a savage world to make her his mate. She had eluded him, and finally I had slain him. But terror and privations and exposure to fierce beasts had haunted her footsteps during all her lonely flight from him. And when I had returned to the outer world, the old trials had recommenced with Hooja in Jubal's role. I could almost have wished for death to vouchsafe her that peace which fate seemed to deny her in this life. I spoke to her on the subject, suggesting that we expire together. "Do not fear, David," she replied. "I shall end my life before ever Hooja can harm me, but first I shall see that Hooja dies." She drew from her breast a little leathern thong, to the end of which was fastened a tiny pouch. "What have you there?" I asked. "Do you recall that time you stepped upon the thing you call viper in your world?" she asked. I nodded. "The accident gave you the idea for the poisoned arrows with which we fitted the warriors of the Empire," she continued. "And, too, it gave me an idea. For a long time I have carried a viper's fang in my bosom. It has given me strength to endure many dangers, for it has always assured me immunity from the ultimate insult. I am not ready to die yet. First, let Hooja embrace the viper's fang." So we did not die together, and I am glad now that we did not. It is always a foolish thing to contemplate suicide, for no matter how dark the future may appear today, tomorrow may hold for us that which will alter our whole life in an instant, revealing to us nothing but sunshine and happiness. So, for my part, I shall always wait for tomorrow. In Pellucidar, where it is always today, the wait may not be so long, and so it proved for us. As we were passing a lofty, flat-topped hill through a park-like wood, a perfect network of fiber ropes fell suddenly about our guard, enmeshing them. A moment later, a horde of our friends, the hairy gorilla men, with the mild eyes and long faces of sheep, leapt among them. It was a very interesting fight. I was sorry that my bonds prevented me from taking part in it, but I urged on the brute men with my voice, and cheered old Gur-Gur-Gur, their chief, each time that his mighty jaws crunched out the life of a Hoojin. When the battle was over, we found that a few of our captors had escaped, but the majority of them lay dead about us. The gorilla men paid no further attention to them. Gur-Gur-Gur turned to me. "Gur-Gur-Gur and all his people are your friends," he said. "One saw the warriors of the Sly One and followed them. He saw them capture you, and then he flew to the village as fast as he could go and told me all that he had seen. The rest you know. You did much for Gur-Gur-Gur and Gur-Gur-Gur's people. We shall always do much for you." I thanked him, and when I told him of our escape and our destination, he insisted on accompanying us to the sea with a great number of his fierce males. Nor were we at all loath to accept his escort. We found the canoe where I had hidden it, and bidding Gur-Gur-Gur and his warriors farewell, the three of us embarked for the mainland. I questioned Juag upon the feasibility of attempting to cross to the mouth of the great river of which he had told me, and up which he said we might paddle almost to Sari. But he urged me not to attempt it, since we had but a single paddle and no water or food. I had to admit the wisdom of his advice, but the desire to explore this great waterway was strong upon me, arousing in me at last a determination to make the attempt after first gaining the mainland and rectifying our deficiencies. We landed several miles north of Thuria, in a little cove that seemed to offer protection from the heavier seas which sometimes run, even upon these usually Pacific oceans of Pellucidar. Here I outlined to Dian and Juag the plans I had in mind. They were to fit the canoe with a small sail, the purposes of which I had to explain to them both, since neither had ever seen or heard of such a contrivance before. Then they were to hunt for food which we could transport with us, and prepare a receptacle for water. These two latter items were more in Juag's line, but he kept muttering about the sail and the wind for a long time. I could see that he was not even half convinced that any such ridiculous contraption could make a canoe move through the water. We hunted near the coast for a while, but were not rewarded with any particular luck. Finally, we decided to hide the canoe and strike inland in search of game. At Juag's suggestion, we dug a hole in the sand at the upper edge of the beach and buried the craft, smoothing the surface over nicely and throwing aside the excess material we had excavated. Then we set out away from the sea. Traveling in Thuria is less arduous than under the midday sun, which perpetually glares down on the rest of Pellucidar's surface. But it has its drawbacks, one of which is the depressing influence exerted by the everlasting shade of the Land of Awful Shadow. The farther inland we went, the darker it became, until we were moving at last through an endless twilight. The vegetation here was sparse and of a weird, colorless nature, though what did grow was wondrous in shape and form. Often we saw huge lidi, or beasts of burden, striding across the dim landscape, browsing upon the grotesque vegetation or drinking from the slow and sullen rivers that run down from the lidi plains to empty into the sea in Thuria. What we sought was either a thag, a sort of gigantic elk, or one of the larger species of antelope, the flesh of either of which dries nicely in the sun. The bladder of the thag would make a fine water bottle, and its skin, I figured, would be a good sail. We traveled a considerable distance inland, entirely crossing the land of awful shadow and emerging at last upon that portion of the Leedy Plains which lies in the pleasant sunlight. Above us the pendant world revolved upon its axis, filling me especially, and Dian to an almost equal state, with wonder and insatiable curiosity as to what strange forms of life existed among the hills and valleys and along the seas and rivers which we could plainly see. Before us stretched the horizonless expanses of vast Pellucidar, the Leedy Plains rolling up about us, while hanging high in the heavens to the northwest of us, I thought I discerned the many towers which marked the entrances to the distant Mahar city, whose inhabitants preyed upon the Thurians. Juag suggested that we travel to the northeast, where, he said, upon the verge of the plain we would find a wooded country in which game should be plentiful. Acting upon his advice, we came at last to a forest jungle, through which wound innumerable game paths. In the depths of this forbidding wood we came upon the fresh spoor of Thag. Shortly after, by careful stalking, we came within javelin range of a small herd. Selecting a great bull, Juag and I hurled our weapons simultaneously, Dian reserving hers for an emergency. The beast staggered to his feet, bellowing. The rest of the herd was up and away in an instant, only the wounded bull remaining, with lowered head and roving eyes, searching for the foe. Then Juag exposed himself to the view of the bull. It is a part of the tactics of the hunt, while I stepped to one side behind a bush. The moment that the savage beast saw Juag, he charged him. Juag ran straight away, that the bull might be lured past my hiding place. On he came, tons of mighty bestial strength and rage. Dian had slipped behind me. She, too, could fight a Thag should emergency require. Ah, such a girl! A rightful empress of a Stone Age by every standard which two worlds might bring to measure her. Crashing down toward us came the bull Thag, bellowing and snorting, with the power of 100 outer earthly bulls. When he was opposite me, I sprang for the heavy mane that covered his huge neck. To tangle my fingers in it was the work of but an instant. Then I was running along at the beast's shoulder. Now the theory upon which this hunting custom is based is one long ago discovered by experience, and that is that a Thag cannot be turned from his charge once he has started toward the object of his wrath, so long as he can still see the thing he charges. He evidently believes that the man clinging to his mane is attempting to restrain him from overtaking his prey, and so he pays no attention to this enemy, who, of course, does not retard the mighty charge in the least. Once in the gait of the plunging bull, it was but a slight matter to vault to his back, as cavalrymen mount their charges upon the run. Juag was still running in plain sight ahead of the bull. His speed was but a trifle less than that of the monster that pursued him. These Pellucidarians are almost as fleet as deer. Because I am not is one reason that I am always chosen for the close-in work of the Thag hunt. I could not keep in front of a charging Thag long enough to give the killer time to do his work. I learned that the first and last time I tried it. Once astride the bull's neck, I drew my long stone knife, and, settling the point carefully over the brute's spine, drove it home with both hands. At the same instant I leapt clear of the stumbling animal. Now no vertebrate can progress far with a knife through his spine, and the Thag is no exception to the rule. The fellow was down instantly. As he wallowed, Juag returned, and the two of us leapt in when an opening afforded the opportunity and snatched our javelins from his side. Then we danced about him, more like two savages than anything else, until we got the opening we were looking for, when simultaneously our javelins pierced his wild heart, stilling it forever. The Thag had covered considerable ground from the point at which I had leapt upon him. When, after dispatching him, I looked back for Dian, I could see nothing of her. I called aloud, but receiving no reply, set out at a brisk trot to where I had left her. I had no difficulty in finding the self-same bush behind which we had hidden, but Dian was not there. Again and again I called, to be rewarded only by silence. Where could she be? What could have become of her in the brief interval since I had seen her standing just behind me? End of chapter 11.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, for thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.